Hello and a very warm welcome to Awakening. It's very good of you to join us again this week for a fifth in a series of programs on the very important issue and the long-awaited objective of Islamic unity. Now, over the last few weeks, we've been talking about the meaning of Islamic unity as the first thing we had to clarify. We also discussed the most important causes of disunity, division and discord within the Muslim community, and also saw how reasonable and practical Islamic unity actually was. Coming up in this program, how could we get rid of some misconceptions that unfortunately are frequently held by a number of Muslims about their fellow Muslim brothers and sisters belonging to other Islamic schools of thought? Plus, how could we make mass media work towards developing the feeling of fraternity among Muslims, and how easy, or rather how difficult is it for Muslims to get the best of the internet without damaging their sense of solidarity? Also coming up, how effective, relevant and successful have the efforts made by certain Islamic scholars and activists been in promoting the cause of Islamic unity? And finally, we'll ask our guests to tell us about the practical and doable mechanisms which can help us achieve unity among Muslims. It's great to have your company. Hello again, and thanks very much indeed for staying with us. Now, without further ado, let's get to know our two great guests. In our Qom studio, we have the pleasure of having a great educator and a scholar with us. Dr. Ahmad Al-Hashimi, welcome to Awakening.
Hello?
I say hello to you.
You hear me?
Right, yes, of course. Now, Dr. Al-Hashimi, you arrived in Iran a few days ago. Have you enjoyed your stay so far?
Very much. I saw the pleasure of meeting a number of colleagues and those whom I haven't seen for a while. And I presented a paper at the 27th annual conference on Quran recitation and memorization.
Great. So it's great to have you with us. Now, Dr. Ahmad Al-Hashimi is the founding director of Ihsan Muslim Heritage Society in Toronto. He has presented several impressive articles at international conferences, including those on Mahdism and Doctrine in Tehran. Two of his recent works are titled Quranic Evidences Heralding the Mahdi's Coming, and as Dr. Al-Hashimi himself pointed out, it was presented at the 27th annual conference on the Holy Quran and necessary preparations for hastening Al-Mahdi's coming. Now, crossing over to our Washington DC studio, I'm very pleased to be joined by a brilliant speaker and a great scholar. Imam Muhammad Al-Asi, welcome to Awakening.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be on your program.
The pleasure is all ours. Now, just a little background on Imam Muhammad Al-Asi. Elected Imam of the Islamic Center of Washington, D.C., Imam Al-Asi is an established educator and an eminent writer. His publications include the first Quranic exegesis to be written originally in English. Now, last week we talked about certain misconceptions that unfortunately are frequently held by a number of Muslims when they think of other brothers and sisters belonging to other Islamic schools of thought. I think it's fair to say that many, if not all, of such views are based on misconception and prejudice. Now, Imam Al-Asi, what practical mechanisms do you offer to get rid of such strongly held misconceptions?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. The first comment that I have on that is, many times when we speak about practical steps to bring the Muslims together to a common understanding, it appears to the listener that there could be some type of program that can be implemented within a short period of time,
right,
that will bring about the reconciliation of the Muslim public on the basis of common sense and fraternity. I have to caution the viewers and the listeners that the Islamic differences that have set in during the ages of ignorance, and we're speaking here about centuries, have taken their toll on the Muslim public in such a way that what is needed as a practical step, to use your words, is to launch into an opening up. The Muslim has to open up to the other Muslim. This is the key for a common understanding among the Muslim populations of the world. And we're speaking here about 1.8 billion people. And no one program is going to be able to bring all of these Muslims together within a snapshot period of one generation. This needs a marathon effort to begin to chip away at the misunderstandings right now that substitute for knowledge. Many people from the other perspective or the other Muslim side, they take for granted that they understand the other Muslims very well. And what they do understand is the accumulation of what appears to be at times very distorted information about the other Muslim. Now I can say here, I can use the words Sunni and Shi'i, and but I'd rather use the other Muslim, and you can take your pick. We don't have the up-to-date information about the other Muslim. And there have been internal factors that fed into this in the previous centuries. There's also some external factors that fed into this. And now we find ourselves, the Muslims of the world, the 1.8 billion Muslims that we are speaking about, we find ourselves discommunicated from each other. There are no really highways of communication among the Muslims. And I think in order for us to build this culture of understanding, that's I think the key word, a culture of understanding, we have to open up highways of communication. There has to be a free flow of idea. Now, mind you, the average Muslim is not averse to coordination. And you see, the word unity is a very ambitious word. And I think in time, Muslims will reach that degree of what we refer to as unity. Right. But in the meantime, there has to be cooperation. There has to be coordination, there has to be consolidation of the Muslims in a in an effort that will be transgenerational. And I know, because I've been participating in one of the, I think, pioneer programs of trying to bring about this culture of understanding, and I refer to the Majma Taqrib Bain al Madahib al Islamiyya, which is the effort that is centered in Tehran there, that has been drawing in Islamic scholars from their different backgrounds and their different madahib and their different persuasions from all around the world to try to, let's say, facilitate this opening up of communications among the Muslims. So I said, the as I said, the average Muslim doesn't have any problem with building bridges with the other Muslim. What appears to be the problem is that we have some mainstream media that for their own peculiar interests, and we can trace that eventually to the political powers in the world, but for their own interests, they begin to open up issues of dissent or issues of distraction or issues of accusations from peculiar books of history, and they try to interject that into the daily discourse of the Muslims. It's not something that's on everyone's mind. It doesn't come naturally to a Muslim, to an average thinking Muslim. But once you have some TV programs or some radio programs or some internet programs or some magazines and journals, etc., when they begin to propound the issue that, you know, there are peculiar types of Muslims that are teetering on the brink of being non-Muslims, or there are a particular type of Muslims who we cannot call Muslims at all. And this type of propaganda circulates from time to time. It has its ups and its downs. It has its flare-ups. We go through some periods of time in which there's a flare-up and there are accusations and counter-accusations, which obviously do not help the healing process that has to take place within the Islamic collective mind, if you will. But obviously, from my experience, from my contact with different people and from different regions of the world, there is a propensity among Muslims to join hands and to move forward.
Thank you very much.
From my reading of the condition of the Muslims, the only reason this has not been, up until this very day, this has not come to fruition, the only reason for that is that there's not enough communication among the Muslims. Some Muslims are reserved. They have good intentions, but they just don't want to go public with this issue. I think this reservation and this timidity at not wanting to go public with the issue of Islamic solidarity and the Islamic of the issue of Islamic mutual understanding, this betrays a weakness of thought. We simply don't have enough confidence in our thinking process.
Thank you very much.
In our intellectual capability to bring this about.
Okay, Imam Al-Asi, thank you very much indeed for those words of wisdom. Now we're going to take a short break. After the break, we're going to put a very important question, relevant question actually, to Dr. Ahmed Al-Hashimi, who is actually with us through satellite in our Qom studio. So please do stay with us. Welcome back once again. It's such a great pleasure to have you with us. Now, on our earlier shows, we stressed that unity needs to be communicated to Muslims at grassroots level. And Imam Al-Asi just mentioned the problem of communication and mentioned that effective communication actually is not there at the moment. Now, we know that mass media have the potential to reach and influence large numbers of people, including Muslims from all Islamic schools of thought. But it seems we haven't yet managed to communicate the message of unity this way. Now, Dr. Al-Hashimi, how could we make mass media work towards developing the feeling of fraternity among Muslims?
One of the ways is to highlight the facts that the Quran puts the foundation for this unity. When the Quran says, وَإِنَّ هَذِهِ أُمَّتُكُمْ أُمَّةً وَاحِدَةً وَأَنَا رَبُّكُمْ فَاعْبُدُونَ, and this nation of yours, the nation of Islam, is one nation and I am your Lord, so worship me. I guess it would be a good starting point from the places of worship to make sure that the masajid, the places of worships of the Muslims, are accessible to all Muslim denominations without any discrimination, and we can start with the imams. because as you know, the community leaders and the imams play a significant role in this matter. When they stress the values Sheikh Muhammad Al-Asi highlighted in their sermons and and their reminders to their congregations, that would be a good means to disseminate the knowledge required and reach out and constantly remind the Muslims that they are brothers to each other despite the fact they may differ in the schools of thought they follow.
Right.
As you are aware, one of the connotations of the very word insan comes from yansa. Yansa means to forget. It is for this reason the Quran carries the name of dhikr. Dhikr comes from yudhikr. Yudhikr means to remind. The main reason for God to ask us to pray five times a day is to stay in constant communication with Him. On the same note, these educational processes to the masses, if you like to call them, need to be in a consistent manner. It is not sufficient to say once a year that yes, we have brothers and let us gather together or take part of one demonstration, for example, on the Quds Day or something of that nature, or Eid Day. No, the constant reminder is very crucial. Here I highlight the role of the imams again, especially when they meet their congregations on the Jum'ah prayers. As you are aware, this is a weekly program which can be utilized effectively to bring that bridging needed between the communities. I remember in early 80s, I and Sheikh Al-Asi used to pray in a masjid you see, in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. In the ranks of those who prayed, you could find Muslims who belong to different denominations, because after all, they are praying to God, and they should not put too much stress on these minute differences.
Right.
As a matter of fact, one of the etiquettes of a praying person is when he stands before God in prayer, he should not even pay attention who is standing on his right or left, because his focus has to be God, and that is the manifestation of the ibadah we are talking about.
Right.
Worshipping God, stressing on these values. So when we can give a move to the understanding of the people who take part in our congregations and make them really understand what Islam stands for, and move them from the level of being a Muslim to a higher level of being a mu'min, because as you are aware, every mu'min is a Muslim, but not every Muslim is a mu'min.
Right.
And with that, again, the Quran addresses the group of the believers, i.e. the mu'minun. إِنَّمَا الْمُؤْمِنُونَ إِخْوَةً. This fraternity you spoke about, brotherhood, if you like to call it, is always there among the true believers in the message of Islam. Those who truly believe, of course, they do not allow themselves to go that low in picking up trivial discussions, leave alone, God forbid, taking explosives and destructing, you see, places of worships and bringing havoc and massacre to their Muslim brothers, such as the incident which unfortunately happened in Zahedan.
Great. Now, Dr. Al-Hashmi, just to focus a little bit on the role of mass media, we know that, for example, we have the Islamic Radios and Television Union in Tehran, which is actually comprised of a number of radio and television stations, and the criterion for membership is favoring the idea of Islamic unity. Now, what is your assessment of such unions? Do you think that these unions could help Muslims achieve actually the long-awaited objective of Islamic unity?
The practical steps, as I alluded to, is education. Mm-hmm. I fully agree with my good friend Muhammad Al-Asi that ignorance could be the root of all these diseases.
Right.
Because we say in Arabic, "An-nas a'da ma jahilu." Normally, people pick up enemies from the groups whom they do not understand. So the role of the mass media is to educate the different stratas of the society about each other. There should be good programs to speak about the, for example, imami fiqh in circles who are not following this fiqh, and vice versa, to tell those who follow the imami fiqh and the Ahlul Bayt that, right, yes, the other school of thoughts came from people who were students of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, such as Abu Hanifa and others. So there should be no difference in following the fiqh through various school of thoughts, and we should leave no room for the enemies of Islam to come and create cracks in the fronts of the Muslim Ummah. And of course, the Muslim Ummah, when it is united, it has a well-built front, which is not crackable, and they can pursue their own goals.
Great.
So the education is number one. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Islamic government, when it gives the right of the different denominations, there should be no resentment that, yes, we have no masajid, such as the those who spread some propaganda here and there, that so-and-so denomination has no masajid in so-and-so country. There should be no reason for any Muslim denomination for not having the way of their worship. As you know, the tolerance is there even to the non-Muslims. The synagogues and the churches, you see, are operational in all over Muslim land, and nobody put any condition, you see, on their operation, and nobody forced them to change their belief.
Okay, great.
To a greater extent, this tolerance and this harmony should be promoted among the followers of different Muslim school of thoughts.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Al-Hashim. Now it's time for us to take a short break, but stay with us if you can, because it's still to come in about the next 20 minutes or so. How difficult is it for Muslims to get the best of the internet without damaging their sense of solidarity? And how effective, relevant and successful have the efforts of certain Muslim scholars and activists been in uniting Muslims? Hello again, it's such a great pleasure to have you back with us. Now, as you know, we're joined in our Washington studio by Imam Muhammad Al-Asi. Now, Imam Al-Asi, you're the author of the first Quranic exegesis to be written originally in English. You finally launched your tafsir at the presence of hundreds of Muslims in the US. Now, in what way is your exegesis different from other exegeses that we have at the moment?
Yes, and I really appreciate you presenting that question, because I've been working on this for over a decade, and a lot of work has gone into it. Of course, the exegesis or the tafsir that I've been working on for all of these years stands out from many other tafsirs in the sense that it is in real time. Many tafsirs, they rely on the past. And many of them, they get absorbed in the because the Quran, it contributes. There's so much in it. It gives a lot. You can come at it from different directions. And I'm not trying to knock down any of the tafsirs that are around. The only major distinction between the other tafsirs and the tafsir that I am writing is that the tafsir that I am writing tries to dot the I's and cross the T's. It tries to give the current characters in the world their Quranic description. And there are many words in the Quran, there are many ayat that are specific to the human condition. What many tafsirs have failed to do is to locate that human condition and then relate it to the meanings of the Quran, or in another sense, to take the meanings of the Quran and then drop these meanings on the human circumstances that they describe. This tafsir does exactly that. That's why I say that it is a tafsir in real time, which means that every generation needs at least a few tafsirs in real time for us to get a grasp on reality, because this Quran deals with the real human being, the human condition, human nature, human development, human interaction. It is a book that is open in many spheres of human activity. And we have to begin to research and to investigate the extended meanings of the Quran into our daily lives. And this is, you see, my dear brother, Dr. Ahmed Al-Hashimi, he used the word believers and worship and Lord. I think these are, with all due respect to the Judeo-Christian terminology, I think these are words that belong to the Judeo-Christian explanation of the Bible. They don't belong to us. These stifle the meanings of the Quran. When we come and say a mu'min, I'm just giving you an example. When we come and say a mu'min is a believer, what does that mean? Especially for us who read the Quran, what does that mean? If we are familiar with the word iman and mu'min, we know that it has two components. It has aman and it has amana in it. So, but aman means security and amana means trust. But when you come and use the word believer in English, where does that, does anyone using the word believer or listening to the word believer, does anyone think about these two concepts of trust and security? Obviously not. Anyone who knows the English language will tell you no, that has nothing to do with it.
Right.
And so, and you can go on and on from here. So if anyone opens the pages that I've worked on in trying to deliver the meanings of the Quran to the reader, they will find that the translation and the development of the meanings of the ayat in the Quran are free from the Judeo-Christian terminology, and therefore the reader becomes more attached to reality. You can understand the world much, much better, because there's no longer the blockage that was there for people of previous scriptures, and how they did a job, so to speak, on understanding their own scripture, not to speak about the inaccuracies that have set in. But when it comes to the Quran, we say all thanks and appreciation is due to Allah, that the Quran in its wording, it's different from its understanding, in its wording has remained exactly the same. Not one letter, not one syllable or vowel has changed in it. Now, when we come to understanding it, here is where the understanding of the Quran, and what I mean by that is the rational understanding of the Quran, in and of itself is an element that brings together Muslims, even though it will tolerate some differences of opinion. Because there's a saying, and those who are familiar with the area of the Qur'an, those who study the Qur'an and read the Qur'an closely with their minds present, of course, they know that Al-Qur'anu hammalu awjuh. This is a saying that is prevalent among the scholars of Islam from ancient times up until now. Of course, those who think, once again, which means the Qur'an tolerates different points of view. That is human points of view. Now, I can go into a lot of detail on this, but I know this session is not allocated to speak about this area. Suffice it to say that what is absent and what has its reflection on the disunity and the divisions of the Muslims of today is the absence of a rational approach to the meanings of the Quran. That means, in a few words, that when we recite the Qur'an, when we read the Qur'an, when we listen to the Qur'an, we do so more with our emotions and with our sentimentality, more than we do with our minds and our rationality. This is the absent dimension between us and Allah's revealed eternal and last book, the Holy Qur'an. And this is the element that has to reintegrate into this process. When we read the Qur'an, if we read it with our minds, we will begin to understand that we have our differences. We have our different points of view. We may have differing interpretations, but not to the extent of disunity. They are always within the boundaries of togetherness. So if we understand a certain ayah in a certain way, that does not give us the license to separate from each other, much less it does not give us a license to harbor bad feelings towards each other. Therefore, taking it from there, any rational Muslim who is reading and understanding the Quran as it is meant to be understood cannot find a justification for having a distance between him and the other Muslim. Granted, the other Muslim may have areas of ignorance to him or her, but that cannot be dealt with by applying bad feelings or ill will. This is no way to solve this problem. The problem has to be solved by the rationalization of the meanings of the Quran, because it is meant to speak, the Quran, Allah's uniting word, is meant to speak to our minds. Thus the mind becomes the cement in the unity of the Muslims. Absent this cement, we will have the Quran in our presence, and we've had the Quran in our presence for 14 centuries. But many of these centuries, especially in the past century, we've seen that politically, we have 57 or 60 odd nation states. That we're supposed to be one ummah, wa anna hadhihi ummatukum ummatan wahida. We're supposed to be one consolidated political group of people. We look at ourselves nowadays, you look around, look at the political map of the world, and you'll find we're approaching 60 different nation states. That is an indictment of our inability to communicate with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Thank you very much.
We just don't get the message. We don't get it. This is what happens when our mind is on leave.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Imam Al-Azhi. We'll take a short break, but after the break, we'll be putting a very important question and rather personal question to Dr. Ahmad Al-Hashimi in our former studio. So please do stay with us. Hello again. It's such a great pleasure that you're staying with us today. Now, Dr. Hashemi, we just have, I think, about 3 minutes to the end of the show, and I'd like to put a rather personal question to you. You were supposed to actually present your work titled Quranic Evidences Heralding the Mahdi's Coming, and you actually presented that at the 27th Annual Conference on the Holy Quran. Now, out of 400 articles, yours was among the five top ones after passing two review committees. Now, what made your article stand out?
I guess its originality, just to be very brief. Mm-hmm. What I stressed on to make distinct for the reader, mm-hmm. that we have three worlds: our physical world, in which the day is 24 hours, the world of angels,
right.
The day of it is 1,000 years, and the world of unseen, mm-hmm. the day of it is 50,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So from the duration of the day, I made it clear that we have three distinct worlds, but these are interwived depending on nothing but Quranic verses.
Right.
I made it in a very tabulated form and took the argument one step higher for those who are good in physics, to speak about the light, because you know, the equation 1,000 years equals one day in the world of angels can be used to compute the speed of light.
Right.
And I concluded that the Quran spoke about the relativity theory, because here we are talking about two relative worlds, 12 centuries before the birth of Albert Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
So the Quran is telling us about lots of the secrets in this universe, and when it comes to the light is the source of life on planet Earth, because only a portion of a billionth of the rays emitted from the sun comes to sustain
we
the
have
life
1 minute
on
left.
Earth, as you know, with a distance of 93 million miles away. And after all, the solar system is nothing but a minute system in this vast universe of God. And the Quran says, "Wassama banaynaha bi'aidin wa inna lamusi'un." God, the sovereign creator, says that we are the ones who have created whatever is above your horizons, and we are expanding it further and further and further. So when we talk about the unseen, what the Quran describes
it
at the beginning of chapter of Al-Baqarah, Alif Lam Mim Dhalika Al-Kitab La Rayba Fee Hudan Lil-Muttaqeen Alladhina Yu'minuna Bil-Ghayb. So the world of unseen is something which is a key point in our belief. It is being addressed at the very beginning of the Quran, and we need to have a better appreciation of this world. And I
Thank you very much.
Very clear on explaining this to the layman, and I'm so proud that a number of university professors who were on these two committees evaluated favorably this article, and I am thankful to the Department of Endowment for presenting
a
symbolic gift to me for that purpose.
Great, we are very happy to hear that, and I know that physics have actually had a great impact on your studies, including Quranic, your Quranic studies. Okay, thank you very much to both of you. Now, before I go, I'd like to thank again my top guests, Imam Muhammad Al-Asi, elected Imam of the Islamic Center of Washington, D.C., and Dr. Ahmad Al-Hashimi, founding director of Ihsan Muslim Heritage Society in Toronto. I'm very grateful to both of you. Until next time, from me, our guests, and the rest of the team, is goodbye for now. Thanks for watching.
gaze towards the faith, upright, in which nature was wrought, mankind, by God. There is no alteration in God's creation. This is religion true and right, but not is the knowledge of many men.
Hello, we're here with another Iran Today. For this program, we have traveled to Sijan in the province of Kerman. 50 kilometers outside the city is where we are at right now, on the site of Golagohar Iron Ore Company. The company is one of the leading mining industrial companies of the Middle East. But it has the potential to become the biggest in the country and even the world. Let's go inside for a deeper look.
Golagohar Iron Ore Complex that consists of six anomalies was first discovered by Iran Barit Company in 1969, and then it was delegated to Iranian National Steel Company. The extraction of this mine, the history of extraction goes back to 900 years ago, and some historians believe that mine activities was carried on 2,500 years ago, at the time of great Persian Empire at Persepolis.
Golagohar Iron Ore Company is one of the biggest iron ore mine in Iran. It has more than 1 billion tons ore reserves in here in six anomalies that we are working on the mine number one with 190 million tons from 1993 until now. We are one of the top 100 company in Iran.
Production operations in Golagohar starts from extraction of iron ore from mine and ends in producing concentrate in processing plant. With the start of a pelletizing plant, our final product will be pellet. The main objective of Golagohar Iron Ore Company is supplying Fulad Mubarak Steel Making Company and Ahvaz Steel Making Company with 5.5 million tons of concentrate. Before the foundation of Golgohar, all this amount was imported from abroad. Now we are in mine number one. The place that we are standing now is 120 meters below the topography. About the extraction sequences, if I want to speak about it, the first stage is will begin with drilling. The equipment will drill some holes in some specified characteristics. That some holes will make a pattern, we call it pattern. It consists of, for example, 40, 50 holes. After the drilling is finished, we will charge it with some explosive, and then it will be blasted. The result of blasting is the crushed ore. The ore that you see is now very easy to be loaded by the electric showers. The electric showers will load the crushed ore into the trucks. There are 100, the capacity of the trucks are about 100 short tons. And after they are loaded completely, they will be sent to the crusher. It depends to the material that the equipment loads. If they are suitable for crusher, they will directly be sent to the crusher. If they are waste or something that are not suitable for the crusher and then for the processing plant, they will be hauled to the dumps, for example, waste dump and overburden dumps. Construction of hematite reclamation plant is one of Golgohar projects that will produce concentrate from the tailing of processing plant. It was started last year, and we hope that it will go on operation by the next year.
Golego has greatest advantage over other companies is its geographical location. Alongside the rich ore deep in its heart, it also has great shipping potential being connected to many major cities by road. There's also a major airport nearby, and it's right beside the National Railway.